books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got a fairy tale exhibition. Amelia Hilton reviews Time Code of a Face, and I chat to Julie Kaplan about her brand new book that's just out, The Hotel by the Sea.
All that and more on today's Read On.
But first on today's show, some news. The ARIAs are the UK Audio and Radio Awards presented annually to recognise, honour and reward outstanding shows and the teams behind them. Judged by over 200 senior audio and radio practitioners, drawn from all sectors of the industry, it's a huge accolade to be nominated. And Read On, the audiobook show, this very show, has been nominated for an ARIA in the Best Speech Entertainment category. Other nominees in this category are Zoe Ball, Joe Wiley, Louis Theroux, Matt Chorley, Jamila Jamil and Rylan, amongst many others. So I'm up against some heavy hitters. The ceremony is at the Roundhouse in Camden on May the 21st, so please, fingers crossed. So, no pressure on today's show then. First up on today's show, let's experience some fairy tales with Toby Davey.
We are off on a family adventure through magical worlds and enchanted stories now here on RNIB Connect Radio to discover how some of those traditional fairy tales we know so well have been transformed over the years in the British Library's Fairy Tales exhibition, which has large print and braille resources available for young, blind and partially sighted people, which is on until the 23rd of August 2026. Joining me now is Rebecca Campbell Gay, one of the curators of the British Library's Fairy Tales exhibition, who's going to tell me a little bit more about the exhibition and the accessible resources too. Hello, Rebecca. It's lovely to have you with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having me, Toby.
I think we can all remember some of those classic fairy tales being read to us when we were younger and reading them ourselves too. And I can certainly remember reading many of the Brothers Grimm fairy tales, which have definitely stuck in my mind too. Rebecca, why was now a good time to look back at how some of those classic fairy tales have been transformed over the years at the British Library in the Fairy Tales exhibition?
Yes, so obviously, as you mentioned, fairy tales transport us from our daily lives into worlds of magic and enchantment. They're filled with fantastical characters, such as talking animals, imaginary creatures, unlikely heroes who outwit villains. And they also take us on exciting quests into mysterious lands. Here at the library, we're really excited to be building upon the success of our family programme and also previous exhibitions such as Story Explorers to deliver this family-focused exhibition. And I think fairy tales have always been shared together by families across generations and around the globe. And we hope the exhibition is an opportunity for families to spend time together discovering the magic and power of these stories.
And this is very much an interactive exhibition for young people. So, Rebecca, do give me a little bit of an idea as to how some of these fairy tales are being brought to life through the exhibition, as I believe visitors are able to go through the deep dark wood to royal palaces and are even able to sit at the Three Bears breakfast table and even smell some of the Wicked Witch's potions too.
Yes, so it is very much an interactive experience. We're inviting families to come with us on an adventure. You'll begin your journey in our storyteller's cottage, where we explore wondrous tales from around the world. There's a huge hearth with a video introduction, and also hidden in this section is a giant bed. Then you'll venture out, as you mentioned, into our deep dark woods, where we meet brave heroes and surprising villains. You'll have the opportunity to explore our gingerbread house, which you can walk into and transform into your favourite fairy tale character with our exciting dressing up wardrobe. We have an enchanting palace, as you mentioned, where magic's awaiting with spells, wishes and enchanted objects. And there, like you say, you can visit our potions table if you're brave enough, or awaken our genius lamp. And then we finish in far, far away, where you'll discover magical creatures from talking bears and cats to selkies, mermaids and trolls. And as you mentioned, we can sit down with the free bears, or perhaps if you're brave, you might trip-trap over our Trolls Bridge.
And how is the Fairy Tales exhibition being made accessible to young, blind and partially sighted people, as the British Library has been working closely with the RNIB on the exhibition?
Yes, so we have lots of wonderful tactile interactives as part of the experience. So as I mentioned, you'll be able to feel our accessible gingerbread house with raised sweets and candy cane barred windows. We have a Princess and the Pea bed, which you can choose to slide down. Or we also have an alternative interactive where you can lift the covers off to discover the pea hidden underneath. We have our genie and our magic mirror, where you can feel the lamp and hear them talk to you. And you can touch Cinderella's glass slipper. You can sit at the free bears table and feel the porridge bowls, or walk over our gnarled bridge and hear the troll. There are smells at our potions table, and there are also soundscapes in each of the sections, which will help to evoke the fairy tale world you're stepping into. For families, we also have sensory backpacks, which the RNIB have been supporting us with. These include tactile objects that respond to the fairy tale worlds. There's a tactile map of the exhibition, which uses Braille, and also tactile drawings of some of the key collection items and loans on display. At the very end of the exhibition, we have a reading space where families will be able to snuggle up together and discover some of the stories. And included in that are access to books, where we have large print and Braille versions of the stories. And we also have on request living painting stories as well.
And am I right in thinking that the RNIB's version of Little Red Riding Hood, Red and the Wolf, which has its main character having a visual impairment, also features in the exhibition?
Yes, as you know well, we know how incredibly powerful and important it is to see yourself positively represented in a book. So we were really delighted to work with RNIB to include Red and the Wolf. As you mentioned, this is a version of Little Red Riding Hood, where the hero is a young girl with a visual impairment who uses a cane. But she's also highly skilled at martial arts, and she uses her talents to overpower the wolf and tame him. And spoiler, it does turn out he's a very good baker. So you'll be able to see that wonderful book within the exhibition, and there's also a Braille label accompanying it.
And I think that just sort of shows how many of these classic fairy tales have been adapted and changed over the years, but still with the sort of main story staying intact.
Yes, I think we do recognise that many traditional fairy tales often contain unhelpful representations, and we hoped within the exhibition, by including loans from contemporary authors and illustrators, we could really celebrate difference in the fact that anyone can be the hero of their story. We also have, for example, Rick and Perec's wonderful illustrations of Cinderella, where she's in a wheelchair and she's a Cinderella who does not want to go to the ball. And we have Adam D'Souza's beautiful preparatory sketches for Girl in the Glass Mountain, which celebrates a princess with hair loss. So we really hope that audiences visiting our exhibition will see themselves celebrated. And as we know, we are all storytellers, and we hope that our families will leave inspired to create the fairy tales that we need for the future.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic exhibition. Rebecca, where can people go to find out more about the Fairy Tales exhibition at the British Library, the large print and Braille and other resources for blind and partially sighted people, and other services that the British Library provides for visually impaired and other disabled young people?
Yes, so all the information is on our website, which is bl.uk. To find out about our accessible events, you can go to bl.uk/learning, and that's where we'll be putting all our accessible events linked to the exhibition. We are hoping to do a really exciting event around fairy tales with RNIB, and we will also have relaxed openings of the exhibition for those who require a much more controlled sensory environment. And we also do a lot, we have wonderful access program here at the library. We will have audio described tours of the exhibition for adults, and we also have a series of monthly workshops for visually impaired adults, which over the fairy tale run will be inspired by the exhibition. So you'll be able to find out about all of those and upcoming events on our website.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Rebecca, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and giving me a great insight into the Fairy Tales exhibition at the British Library.
Thank you so much for having me. We look forward to seeing you at the exhibition.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to Toby Davey. Later in the show, we'll be reviewing Ruth Ozeki's Time Code of a Face, and we'll spend some time with Julie Kaplan at the Hotel by the Sea. But first, let's hear about some books you might have missed entering the RNIB Library.
For those who enjoy historical family stories, we have The Chimney Sweep's Sister by Emma Hornby, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
The last of the coal had been fed to the fire hours ago. Hands on hips, Jenny scanned through narrowed eyes the sparse single room of their cellar dwelling, and not for the first time, in search of an alternative to sacrifice for fuel. She hadn't two farthings to rub together until her brother arrived back from his toil later and would hand over his meagre daily wage. Therefore, buying in fresh supplies was out of the question. And she must have a fire if she was to cook. Young Noah would be ravenous upon his return. Furthermore, the temperature outside was cruel and only set to worsen with the hours. Numbers would be into the minuses by nightfall, she'd bet. Without warmth, they would surely catch their deaths from pneumonia before a new dawn rolled around. Think, think!
Orphaned Jenny and her chimney sweep brother Noah eke out life in a cellar dwelling in the heart of the slums. Noah is the main breadwinner, but he's treated horribly by his master. Worried for her brother's safety and health, Jenny resolves to put her talent for singing to good use and begins trawling the low inns and taverns at night, entertaining the punters. When she catches the attention of a music hall manager and is offered a spot on the stage, it seems like a dream come true. But her newfound success can't include her brother. Will Jenny choose Noah over the bright lights of the theatre? And will he want her to?
Again, she took stock of their belongings, such as they were. The small battered table and two rickety stools set beneath the strip of high window. Two tin bowls, two mugs and two spoons stacked on the bare floor by the hearth, beside the solitary black-bottomed cooking pot. The lumps of straw-filled sacking in the far alcove, atop which were folded neatly several threadbare blankets and matted shawls, which served as their bed. However, there was nothing they could afford to part with. Every item was a necessary one and would only need replacing, meaning the loss of vital and precious pennies. Shrugging, her mind made up, she went to collect the small hatchet from the mantelpiece. The weapon swinging loosely in her hand, Jenny crossed to the steep set of wooden stairs to her right that led up to the front door. There had been 8 steps at one time. Now, but 5 remained. She bit her lip and contemplated whether the loss of a few more would hamper greatly their passing in and out of the home. Then desperation had her throwing caution to the wind and taking aim. She lifted the hatchet above her head. A fire was burning merrily in the grate, and the evening meal of scrag end stew was bubbling away nicely in the pot suspended from a hook above the flames, when footsteps from outside filtered down. Jenny craned her neck in readiness to welcome her brother, hastening to add as he opened the door, "Oh, lad, mind yon steps, there's a couple more gone." Noah accepted this news with an easy nod and deftly jumped the distance into the room. He hurried to the fire and held out his soot-encrusted hands to it gratefully. "By, it's cold out." "Aye." "I'm fair clemmed, our Jen." As though to cement the fact, his stomach released a low growl of hunger. "How long will the grub be?" She motioned to the table. "Not long, lad. Sit thee down and pour yourself a sup of tea whilst thou waits."
The The Chimney Sweep Sister by Emma Hornby is read by Nikki Patel and runs for 8 hours 56 minutes.
Recently added to our history collection, Windrush, 75 Years of Modern Britain by Mike and Trevor Phillips, was donated by HarperCollins.
Interview with Lloyd Miller. Lloyd Miller came to Britain from Jamaica in 1949 and worked as a builder in Notting Hill.
We didn't have much job, you know, things like that, but plenty of people work for themselves, you know, and like cultivating. After you cultivate, you can send a little crop to, you know, to the higher one. They ship it away to go to England, Canada, you know, like banana. And what you're growing, you can ship it away, you know. So if you could put it this way, if you could make a few shillings for yourself, then you're all right. But if you couldn't make it, it was very hard. See, so that's the reason why I said to myself, I don't want to stop here to grow old and, you know, I want to travel and make something.
Broadcaster Trevor Phillips and his novelist brother Mike retell the very human story of Britain's first West Indian immigrants and their descendants from 1948 to the present day. In 1948, the troop ship Windrush brought the first West Indian immigrants to Great Britain. Originally published 50 years later, Trevor and Mike Phillips' seminal book uses the first-person accounts of those on board, as well as those of their descendants, friends, neighbours and politicians, to tell the story of Black British life in the 20th century. Moving through crucial events in Black social history and tracing the impact of immigration throughout the decades, Windrush covers topics across politics, culture and society, from race riots to Powellism to Carnival and cricket. Updated to coincide with the 75th anniversary of the ship's voyage, including reflections on the legacy of Windrush in 2022, this compelling book is a true celebration of Black British history and heritage.
I went to St. Anne and stopped at a sugar estate there called Richmond and worked there for a while. That was about 59 miles from where I lived. I walked to go there, but you only have seasonal work in those places because the sugar producing season, that only lasts about 6 months or thereabouts. You either go on further or you return to your place. I returned. It wasn't very profitable, but at least there was something to do. And so as the time went on, you travelled. Get in where you can, but those days were hard days. I had left Jamaica before. I went to Panama when they were recruiting people for the Panama Canal, you know, when the war started. And that was all the war effort because I had to work as a commissary there. And the money wasn't all that, but it was something. And people going away, that's the only way you see people. Most Jamaicans who have at that time had anything, they had travelled. They didn't make it at home because very few people could work and get well off, you know, with the wages they earn in Jamaica. Some people could do because, I mean, there are quite a number of people, if they earn £5, they still save something. It doesn't matter what. If you're made that way, you could. But not everyone could.
Windrush, 75 Years of Modern Britain by Mike and Trevor Phillips is narrated by the authors and runs for 20 hours and 58 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
That number again for the RNIB helpline for any sight loss inquiry or for advice on daily living or technology or indeed to join the RNIB library is 0303 123 9999. And now on today's show, let's relax in the sun. Pack your bags and get ready to fall in love with the hotel by the sea. your next romantic getaway from author Julie Kaplan. Julie also writes as Jules Wake, as we'll find out soon. But first, let's hear from the book. The 13th book in her romantic escape series, The Hotel by the Sea, is read by Olivia Dowd.
Rebecca shucked off her flip-flops and dumped her dress on one of the sun lounges. The early morning sun hovered above the horizon, bright gold against a cerulean sky. She smiled. Heaven. The ever-present weight on her shoulders lifted as she surveyed the clear water of the pool. At this time of the day, it was all hers, although, given the size of the little boutique hotel, it was never going to get crowded. In fact, she felt more like a guest rather than the resident Pilates teacher, slash maid, slash waitress. The Rebello family had made her so welcome when she'd arrived yesterday afternoon. It was hard to believe that she was an employee, although she was still slightly distrustful. All this seemed just too good to be true, after the crushing disappointment of the last month. "Enough, Rebecca," she told herself sharply. "You only have yourself to blame." She straightened up, pulled on her goggles, and in one smooth, fluid move, dived into the pool. The shock of the cold took her breath away, and she struck out hard, fighting against the quick instinct to get out of the water. Flip, it was freezing. Forcing herself to keep going, she cut through the pool with a brisk, efficient crawl, her arms pumping as she gradually acclimatized to the temperature. As the saying always went, once you were in, you got used to it. She'd only done a couple of lengths, reveling in the strength and power of her body. She did love to swim. When through her goggles, she became aware of a blurred figure by the pool. She felt the mini tsunami as they dived in.
This book is set in Portugal in a place very close to my heart. It's actually based on a real place on the Algarve, a place called Olhos d'Água that me and my family have been going to for the last 20 years. And it's about a young woman who has been publicly humiliated. The love of her life is not interested. So she flees to Portugal and goes to work in a hotel where she befriends the very handsome manager. Of course he's handsome. He's a very charismatic character who loves and leaves them and isn't interested in permanent relationships because he's too busy running the hotel and supporting his three cousins and his sister and his mum because the hotel was left them 10 years ago when his father died in an accident. So it's about the two characters colliding and thinking, oh, we'll have a bit of fun to start with, and then it all gets a bit more serious and then other things come along and stop them. But eventually they get their happy ending.
Whoever it was, they immediately set a brisk pace, chopping up the water. Slightly irritated by the intrusion and the sudden churning up of her water when she'd been enjoying a relaxed swim, she paused at the end of the pool to observe the interloper. It was a man with deeply tanned skin and dark hair, ploughing up and down in a fierce, determined fashion, as if he were ready to kill someone. She watched his efficient freestyle, impressed by the sheer economy of movement. He had good technique and was fast. A small smile curved her lips. She bet she was faster. She waited until he reached her end of the pool, and when he touched the tiled wall to turn, she pushed off at the same moment, pacing herself to keep up with him. And then, with smug satisfaction that she'd got his measure, she purposefully lengthened her strokes and increased her kicks to overtake him. Reaching the opposite end, she was childishly delighted by the fact that she was three strokes ahead of him. Competitiveness ran through her, and her siblings, like words through a stick of rock. Feeling stupidly pleased with herself, she turned and pushed off again, this time increasing her lead by a couple more strokes. 10 meters in, she realized that he'd put on a spurt of speed and had caught up with her. She glanced over at him. He grinned at her. She grinned back at him. Game on.
So the Quinto de Mar Hotel is fictional, yeah?
It is fictional, but it's based very closely on one of my favourite hotels in the world called Quinto de Mel, which is Honey Farm in English, and it's the most delightful place. You can sit there and just listen to the bird song around you and very little. And they serve beautiful breakfasts. And it's just a really lovely, calm atmosphere.
Now, this is your 13th of your Romantic Escapes books.
Yes, I've written 13 now.
And they've gone all over the world. We'll talk about Tokyo in a minute, but it started in Copenhagen. What was the inspiration behind the little cafe in Copenhagen?
Well, actually, when I was in my early 20s, I was entrusted to take journalists on press trips to very glamorous places. I can't believe they did that now. And I once had to take a trip on a food tasting tour to Italy. And I had the most difficult group of journalists. I kept losing them. In fact, I lost one of them before we left Heathrow. And I just decided this would be a really good premise. So basically, the little cozy cafe in Copenhagen was the first book in the series, where I had a poor PR lady taking a group of six journalists, very different, out to Copenhagen. And she has to basically corral them and round them up. And it's like herding cats, which from personal experience is very true to life.
Now, have you been to all the locations in all your books?
Ah, this is a secret. Don't tell anyone. But I've been to all but two. And those particular two, I just didn't have the time, or there were other reasons I couldn't get, or they were too expensive. But nobody has ever guessed which they are, including one friend who said, oh, I captured it absolutely perfectly.
I'm not going to guess.
It's amazing what you can find out on Google.
The Little Tea Shop in Tokyo by Julie Kaplan. Read by Charlotte Worthing. Haruka-san, this is Fiona. She stepped forward and put both hands together before nodding to Fiona with a polite little bow. Welcome, Fiona. It is very good to meet you. Her smile, though friendly, wasn't quite as effusive as the one Gabe had received. He was obviously very popular round here. Come, come. She led the way with small, neat steps up a flight of stairs that turned right on itself, on a small landing, so that Fiona guessed they were now above the tea shop. She couldn't wait to go inside that, although her curiosity was piqued by the very different Japanese interior. The woman led them into a large living area. It was decidedly minimalist, with very little furniture, and wooden floors, which were covered with large mats, encompassing the entire central floor area. There were a few very low-level chairs with high upright backs, and an odd-looking table that seemed to have its own futon mattress. Apart from a few pottery items on a low-level wooden sideboard and a couple of painted scrolls hanging on the walls, Fiona realised there were very few ornaments and none of the sort of clutter that characterised her mother's house. She smiled. She rather liked the clean lines and tidiness of the room.
But let's talk about the little tea shop in Tokyo, because I toyed with the idea of going to Japan before, but I'd be going for the blossom and the temples. If my son was going, he'd be going for the manga and the robots and things. You describe that sort of separation of the generational divide about Tokyo.
I have to say, you absolutely, in that division of description that you just said, nailed it on the head. It is a country of complete and utter contrasts. They have the most wonderful traditions, like things like kintsugi, where they mend things with golden glue so that it still looks beautiful, but you've got the original there. But the damage to it, so a little chip that's been repaired, is something they treasure because it shows it's been well used and well loved. And then you've got the crazy robots and the modern museums and the arcades and the manga and everything. But they do have a really, really strong tradition of family and honor among the family. And that's what I really try to capture in the book, that sensation that they have these wonderful traditions that are passed down, but they also embrace all these amazing things about technology. It really is an incredible place.
Putting the romantic escapes aside for a second, you also write under the name Jules Wake. Why do you have two separate names?
Oh, dear. This is very much an insight into the author's world. So basically, I have a very, very good working relationship with my editor, who I've worked with for, 15 years now. And she came to me and said, I'd really love you to write a book set in Copenhagen because there's a big trend towards hygge at the moment. And I'd like you to write a book set in Copenhagen that looks at hygge. And that was the whole brief she gave me. And I said, oh, yes, I was like a challenge. So I could write wherever I wanted, but it needed to be set in Copenhagen. She said, I've even got a title for it. It's The Cozy Cafe in Copenhagen. And I just looked at her and thought, that is the most hideous title. It was just so twee. And I really didn't like it. I said, OK, maybe I could do it under my maiden name and sort of separate it from Jules Wake. Because of that, by that time, I'd been building up a bit of a reputation. And she said, oh, that would be great. People love a debut or born again debut. So we went with Julie Kaplan. And I have to say, that book has been my most successful book by far.
And this won't be going out for a couple of weeks, but I believe there is a third name on the way.
There is, which is literally being announced at this very minute on Instagram. So that's my spicy name. So I'm not sure if you read them, but there's a real trend towards much more explicit, spicy romance. And obviously I write a lot of books, but this was a bit of a break for me. So I wrote a couple of spicy romances under the name of Cassie Connor. And you're the first person I've ever told that to, and it's out aloud officially.
Are you not frightened yet you're losing readers if they don't realise that Jules Wake is also Julie Kaplan?
I think my audience tend to be very voracious readers that get to the end of a book and want the next one straight away. So actually, for a lot of them, discovering that I have another name has been like, oh my goodness, you've got more. I think I am a romance reader. I think we're quite greedy. We want to grab everything we can. We just love reading, and the more the merrier.
One question, the Christmas castle in Scotland, is that based on a real place?
No, the image is it. So I looked up a couple of castles in Scotland and chose one I like the look of. And then I just invented the community around it. I mean, I have relatives in Scotland. I spend a lot of time in St Andrews and I absolutely love the Highlands. So it wasn't difficult to imagine anything. But one of the benefits of if you're writing about a place, although I include real places, but I tend to also like the cafe in Copenhagen was not real, because you want to be able to do whatever you want with it and you don't want a reader to turn around, well, the corridor isn't where you said it was and the toilets are at the other end of the building, and you don't want to interrupt that flow. So I tend to the actual locations, the place, the setting might be real, but the buildings themselves will be from my imagination, because then I can do what I want with them.
At the turn, they both launched into the length at the same moment. This time, she pushed harder, all her competitive instincts fully primed. He didn't know who he was up against. She was Rebecca Hayes Love. She didn't do defeat, not in the sporting arena. The relationship part of her life might be a disaster, but growing up with two rugby-mad older brothers had taught her that the only way to survive was to find her own milieu in which to beat them. Running, cycling and swimming were her fight-back weapons, and she'd excelled at all three. Sadly, despite her success, her trophies and medals would never surpass the boys' achievements, which included rugby shields and an England cap, all of which were more highly prized by her parents than her own insignificant efforts. Oops, she'd let her concentration slip. Head in the game, Rebecca. The man was a stroke ahead of her. Not going to happen. He was not going to beat her.
We've heard through the magic of editing a clip of Olivia Dowd reading from The Hotel by the Sea. Did you have any hand in the casting of Olivia?
I did, actually. I'm always sent a list of narrators to listen to, and I think I listened to her and another one, and another Olivia, who has narrated two more of my books. And I chose Olivia Dowd, but I'm quite choosy because I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I absolutely love them. But I do have a bit of a problem. Quite often they give you two narrators, a male and a female, and they have the female reading the female point of view, but then doing the male voice, and then they'll have the male reading the male point of view, but also doing the female voice. And I don't like that crossover. I prefer one narrator who does everything.
Head in the game, Rebecca. The man was a stroke ahead of her. not going to happen. He was not going to beat her. She dug in and focused on powering her arms through the water, kicking hard. She overtook him and turned before him. And now she really went all out, determination powering her moves as she pulled ahead. Even though her lungs were starting to burn, there was no way she was giving up. Not when she was winning. And then she wasn't. Damn it. He was fast. They were neck and neck. They turned at the same time. She went ahead, gliding underwater for a good meter. But seconds after she surfaced, he was there again, now matching her stroke for stroke. Gritting her teeth, she dug deeper, her arms flashing furiously as she sliced through the water. He had stamina, she had to concede, but that was all she would concede. They turned again and she pushed off once more, her arms like windmills slicing through the water. They swam another two lengths, and each time she pulled ahead, he caught up with her. She ignored the lactic acid building up in her muscles. This time, when they reached the end of the length and she touched the wall three strokes ahead, she smirked at herself. Yes, still got it. But as she was about to push off again, she realized that he had stopped. In triumph, she completed the length, grateful to slow down a little. Reaching the other end, she turned to find that he had hauled himself out of the water, and his long, lean, and very tanned legs were dangling in the water. Under the water, she did a little fist bump. She'd outswum him. Mind you, she could barely breathe, so it was gratifying to see that his chest was heaving as much as hers. Her heart pounded so hard that she could feel the blood thudding through her veins. She gulped a little as she studied him further. That was one very fine chest. Tanned, broad and muscular, with the well-toned physique of an athlete, rather than the sharply delineated muscles of a bodybuilder. Definitely a very nice view. Would it be too obvious if she fanned herself for a moment? Taking it more leisurely this time, she swam over and hauled herself onto the side of the pool beside him. His face lit up and he grinned, giving her a weak wave, and still a little out of puff said, "Hi, I think you might have killed me."
Another clip of Olivia Dowd reading from The Hotel by the Sea. Now, I've heard you give readings at talks and book festivals and things. Have you never thought about narrating a book yourself?
Oh, I've got the most awful voice. I think it's really whiny, so I apologise to your listeners because I absolutely hate my voice.
Well, it sounds lovely from this end.
Thank you.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the audio version of The Hotel by the Sea from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
Well, if you were sitting in the sunshine and the sun was shining down on you and you could feel the warmth of it on your skin and the birds around you tweeting, I think the front cover encapsulates that. So it's a really deep blue sky with the sea in the background and a yellow house, because in Portugal a lot of the houses are painted specific colours. And the heroine is leaning out of the window of the, well, it's the hotel, and talking down to the handsome man below her who's looking up at her. But it just encapsulates that warmth and that feeling of sun on your skin.
Now, we're kind of recording this out of order, so the listener will hear later on in Books of Your Life that one of your book choices features someone with writer's block. Is that something you've ever had in real life?
Yes, at the moment. No, I'm joking. I don't believe in writer's block. I think we get stuck, and that's usually because we've gone down the wrong avenue. But with commercial fiction, I write very commercial fiction. I don't have time to get writer's block. I've got a contract to fulfill. This sounds very unromantic, but I treat it like a job. And every day I have to show up and work whether I feel like it or not. So things will get scrapped and tossed away and deleted. But for the most part, you just have to keep writing and it will sort itself out.
When you're writing under different names, is it you think, okay, I don't want to write as Jules Wakesley, I'll write as Julie. Can you chop and change like that? Or is it more contractually obliged?
No. The story's in my head, and I'll be cleaning my teeth and the characters are having a dialogue inside my head. And when I'm writing a book, I'm completely focused on that story and those characters, and I can't really think about anything else. So I'm very much focused on the current book.
And I know it used to be your job to take people round on these tasting trips, but are you travelling to the places regularly? Like, your last book was in Prague. You've got the French Chateau Dream that was just out a couple of years back. Are you actually travelling to these places for research for that actual book?
Yes. So, I mean, the Prague book came about because I'd visited quite a few times, and some of the Prague readers said, "When are you going to set a book here?" I thought, "Oh, actually, it's a rather beautiful place." But I quite often visit a place before I'm going to write about it. I mean, there are exceptions, obviously. Portugal, I didn't need to go. I did go to Lisbon, actually, to do some research, but I didn't need to go to the Algarve. But yes, it's really important to do that research, because you'll find, obviously, there's the famous places. But for example, when I went to Lisbon, I knew all about the steep hills and the funiculars and that sort of thing. But what I didn't know was about the pavements that you see when you're there. Or you would feel them under your feet, because the cobbles are so shiny and very square. And that's a real part of Lisbon that you notice when you're there, which if I hadn't have visited, I wouldn't have picked up on that. And it's so characteristic of the city.
She grinned back, her own lungs working hard to reoxygenate while pure pleasure reverberated in ripples through her. Post-exertion endorphins and feminine appreciation responding to his knockout smile. "Phew, you're fast," she said, once she could breathe again. "You were faster," he acknowledged. She nodded and couldn't help the little smirk of triumph. "Today," he added. She raised an eyebrow. "Next time," he said with a cheeky wink, "I'll take you. I wasn't prepared to find a shark in the pool with me this morning." "I'm game for a rematch any time you want," she replied with a quick laugh. He laughed in response, rivulets of water dripping down a very handsome face, his wide smile revealing strong white teeth against his dark mahogany tan. He could have modelled for a toothpaste ad. He held out a hand. "Felipe." She took it and found his grasp firm and decisive as he gave her hand a quick, respectful shake. "Rebecca," she said with another grin. Who didn't love a good sport?
The Hotel by the Sea is available print, ebook, and in audio, commercially narrated by Olivia Dowd. It's also in the RNIB library in audio. And Julie Kaplan / Jules Wake, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Tibor Fisher, and this is my story, Listed for Trial.
This is Julian Barnes, and I'm reading a story I wrote called The Things You Know.
Hello, my name's Peter Robinson, and I write a series of books featuring DCI Alan Banks.
This is Doris Lessing, and I'm reading a chapter from my novel, The Sweetest Dream.
Hello, I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and I'm reading Sandy and Her Beautiful Sisters, A Modern Fairy Tale, by Antonia Fraser.
Here is the news by Richard Baker, read by the author.
I'm Bill Bryson, reading from my book One Summer, America, 1927.
Hello, this is Faye Weldon, and this is one of my stories. It's called Eyes in the Dark.
This morning I had my usual breakfast of toast and marmalade, which I have to have because that's Paddington's favourite.
This is Julia Donaldson, and you're listening to Talking Books.
My name is Jim Broadbent, and I'm delighted to be reading for Talking Books.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
We'll hear from Jules again later with Books of My Life, but for now, let's hear from Amelia Hilton.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Amelia, and today I'm reviewing Time Code of a Face by Ruth Osecki. What did your face look like before your parents were born? Who are you? What is your true self? These are the questions in Ruth Ozeki's mind as she challenges herself to spend 3 hours gazing into her own reflection, recording every thought and detail. What follows are a lifetime's worth of meditations on race, aging, family, death, the body, self-doubt, and finally, acceptance. In this profound encounter with memory and the mirror, Ozeki weaves together personal history, professional experience, Zen philosophy, Japanese culture, and more to paint a rich, intimate, and utterly unique portrait of a life as told through a face.
Time code: 0 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds. I've put the mirror on the altar where the Buddha used to be. Laptops just below it. Fussing now with the seating, arranging the cushions. How close should I be? How much proximity can I tolerate? How is the lighting? Flattering? Unflattering? Does it matter? Should I change into a turtleneck to hide the lines on my neck? Hide them from whom? Is the neck even part of the face? And do I need to wash my hair? Do I need reading glasses, or can I type without them? Can I see without them? No, no glasses. No need to look at the computer screen. Just face and me, facing off in the mirror. 4 minutes, 14 seconds. Okay, ready. No, wait, there's dust on the mirror. Must clean it. Do I have vinegar? Yes, under the sink. 7 minutes, 26 seconds. Mirror's spotless. 8 minutes, 56 seconds. How do I start?
Ozeki is one of my favourite authors, and I've reviewed some of her books before, but this one is different from her books and any other book that I've read. It really feels like you're in the moment with her as she does this meditation, and I love how detailed the descriptions of her face and her perceptions are. She starts with her forehead, she goes to her eyes, different areas of her skin, and uses these as prompts to reflect on vanity, beauty, her own identity, her relationship with her parents. I love the way in all of her books that she makes the teachings of Zen Buddhism so accessible and relevant to everyday life, and this book is no exception. It's really great to hear how she came to Zen Buddhism and what her own relationship with deciding to become a Zen Buddhist and learning how to be a priest is. And the judgments she has about herself and her aging face are so relatable. It's really, really interesting to hear the two sides of someone who is trying to let go of these judgments, but also trying to understand where they come from and having quite intense exposure to the things about herself she doesn't like through this experiment.
My mom had a dry and ironic sense of humor, and it was often hard to know when she was joking. This was particularly true toward the end of her life, when she had less to joke about. She had Alzheimer's, but managed to be funny in spite of it. When we were out and passed a mirror in a shop or restaurant or doctor's office, she'd stop and stare, and then she'd ask me, "Who is that old woman?" The first time she did this, I immediately assumed she was having an Alzheimer's moment, and so I took a deep breath, swallowed my panic, and explained as gently and reassuringly as I could, "That's you, Mom."
"No," she said, shaking her head. "I've never seen that woman before in my life."
She frowned at her reflection, and then our eyes met in the mirror, and I realized that this was not the dementia talking. She knew perfectly well that she was looking at herself in the mirror, and that she couldn't recognize herself. Both were true. I can relate to this now, and it's only going to get truer as time wears on. Once she asked me, "How old am I?" I told her, "You're 90, Mom." Her eyes widened.
"I am? That's unbelievable. How can I be 90? I don't feel 90.
"How old do you feel?"
40.
Deadpan, perfectly serious. I laughed. "You can't be 40, Mom. Even I'm older than 40. Actually, I was closer to 50 at the time.
"You are?" she explained. "That's terrible."
"Gee, thanks." She shook her head. "You know, I must be getting old. I just can't remember anything anymore."
She looked up at me and blinked. How old am I?
I really love the structure. It's incredibly unique. I don't think I've read anything like it. And it feels like you're zooming into her face and then zooming out into the broader picture of her life or society in general. And it's also fascinating to hear about her time spent in Japan being taught how to create no masks, which is a traditional Japanese theatre form. And she brings together so many different ideas in a really concise and fascinating way. I highly recommend this book. It has so many great qualities, but it's also extremely short, which is lovely, and would be a great one for anyone who enjoys philosophy, hearing people's personal stories, or is even just looking for an unusual form to enjoy in a book. Ruth Ozeki, Time Code of a Face, is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library and is narrated by the author herself. It's 1 hour and 52 minutes long. Thank you so much for listening to this book review on RNIB Connect Radio, and I'll be back with another one soon.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
This whole business of Talking Books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk.
And finally, on today's show, return to Julie Kaplan for the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, there is. The Wizard of Earthsea series by Ursula Le Guin. I think it was the first time I'd read about an imaginary world, and it just completely captured my imagination. In fact, I started reading it again very recently, and of course it's for children, but it just brought back that, oh my goodness, look at this magical world that exists out there in my imagination. And it was a real turning point for me.
The island of Gaunt, a single mountain that lifts its peak a mile above the storm-racked northeast sea, is a land famous for wizards. From the towns in its high valleys and the ports in its dark, narrow bays, many a Gauntishman has gone forth to serve the lords of the archipelago in their cities as a wizard or mage, or, looking for adventure, to wander working magic from isle to isle of all Earthsea. Of these, some say the greatest, and surely the greatest voyager, was the man called Sparrowhawk, who in his day became both dragon lord and archmage. His life is told of in the Deed of Ged and in many songs, but this is a tale of the time before his fame, before the songs were made. He was born in a lonely village called Ten Alders, high on the mountain at the head of the Northward Vale. Below the village, the pastures and ploughlands of the vale slope downwards, level below level, towards the sea, and other towns lie on the bends of the River Aar. Above the village, only forest rises, ridge behind ridge to the stone and snow of the heights. The name he bore as a child, Duny, was given him by his mother, and that and his life were all she could give him, for she died before he was a year old.
A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin is read by Cobna Holdbrook-Smith and is available from RNIB Talking Books, along with the rest of the series.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Oh yes, I absolutely adore this book by Katie Ford, Stately Pursuits. I've lost count of how many times I've read it, and recently I actually bought the audio so I could listen to it again. It's just one of those books. I know the characters inside out, but I just absolutely love it. So that's I call that my comfort read when I'm not feeling very well or my brain's just not in gear.
"Oh, you will be all right, won't you, darling?" said Hetty's mother. It was more of a command than a question. "Well, if I'm not," Hetty muttered, stowing her mother's overnight case in the boot of the Clio, "it'll be your fault." "What's that?" Her mother emerged from putting something on the back seat. "Nothing," Hetty forced a smile. "I'll be fine." "I know you will." Mrs. Longdon spoke as if there had never been any doubt. "You should be all right for money for a while. Samuel seems to have plenty. But let me know if you run short, and I'll sort out a car for you soon. Then you can visit Samuel and not be so isolated." She glanced at the narrow country lane that ran through what had once been the park belonging to the big house. It was edged with beautiful huge trees, but there wasn't another property in sight. "Not that you'll be isolated, exactly." They both knew she was lying. "I said I'll be fine," repeated Hetty. "And if you don't go now, you'll get the rush hour traffic going into Guildford."
Stately Pursuits by Katie Ford is in the RNIB library, as read by Jilly Bond.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, just something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Oh, there's a new book. It's not out yet. I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy. It's called Romantic Hero by Kirsty Greenwood. It's about a romantic writer who's got terrible writer's block. She's been writing a cowboy romance series, and she wakes up and the main character from her book is sitting there in her bedroom. And the rest of the story is about how they get him back to where he should be. It's great fun. And she's a fabulous writer. As soon as it's out, I really recommend it.
Unfortunately, the audio version of Romantic Hero by Kirsty Greenwood isn't available as yet. But as it's published by Penguin, it should enter the RNIB library sometime in June after the book's release.
And once again, Jules, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, every episode is available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.